That's me slamming the door again and escaping out on the bike. Welcome to episode 2 of the Cycling Europe podcast, broadcasting from the heart of the English Pennines. This month we've been on our travels to Belgium, to Spain, and back here to the Calder Valley of Yorkshire. But we're going to kick off in another exotic location. A few years ago, Rob Penn circumnavigated the globe to find components to build his perfect bike. He wrote a book about it, It's All About the Bike, and even turned the whole thing into a fascinating documentary for the BBC. Alas, the Cycling Europe podcast doesn't have the budget of Rob Penn or the BBC for a round-the-world trip, but it can afford a tank of petrol to drive down to the NEC in Birmingham to visit the cycle show and to do a similar kind of thing. Let's imagine that I don't already have a touring bike. Or rather, let's imagine I want to upgrade Reggie the Ridgeback Panorama. Where do I start? Well, how about a rather swanky-looking Ridgeback Panorama 2017 style?
Okay, so my name's David Sharp. I am the National Sales Manager for Madison Sportline, who are one of the largest UK distributors of cycles and cycle parts. We also own a few bike brands, of which Ridgeback is one of our brands. This is the Ridgeback Panorama, which is a model, one of the touring bike models that's been within the range of Ridgeback for a considerable period of time. But certainly over the last maybe 3 or 4 years, this model has seen quite a few updates, which has maybe brought some of the more modern technologies that are in the kind of market of cycling to this area. Now, obviously, Panorama is a touring bike which generally appeals quite often to that more traditional touring market, and they look for reliability, they look for easy fixing bikes so that when they are touring and they're maybe out and about, they can fix things.
So compared to the one that I bought back in 2010, that looks radically different.
Okay, a few of the differences are, probably the biggest one that you'll see is the braking technology. Now, up until a few years back, touring bikes were very traditionally fitted with a rim style brake, so either a cantilever or a mini V-brake. Disc brakes have now become very much standard spec on most bicycles now. So you now have a fully front and rear mechanical disc brake system. The beauty of a mechanical disc brake system is it still is quite simple to fix and it's very easy to make any running alterations to, but it gives you a much more powerful braking system. It means that your rims don't wear out nearly as quickly, and it also means that if there's any buckle or deviation in the wheel, you don't have any interference with the brakes. So again, it means that you can carry on your riding. It also means you can run a much wider rim, which gives you a stronger section on the wheel, and it also means you can run a better profile on the tyre, so it means the bike's a little bit more comfortable. Other kind of differences are that it's gone to a new, on the frame itself, although it's still a steel frame, which is quite a traditional material for touring, it's a Reynolds tube set, and it's now using a much more modern investment cast dropout, which makes the dropouts a lot stiffer and a lot stronger as well on the dropouts. Other running changes that have been made is we're now using Tubus racks on it, Tubus being kind of one of the highest end rack manufacturers, so it's a very durable rack that can be used. So get extremely high weight loadings as well, so these racks can hold upwards of around 40 kilograms of weight on them, so very competent there.
But you don't have one on the front?
So we don't pre-spec this with the front one, but this bike has got full low loader mounts. So it has both internal and external upper mounts and external lower mounts. You can fit any style of front rack to it, whether you want a low loader, whether you want a flat top front rack. This bike, probably back in the day when you bought it, did come pre-equipped with a front and rear rack. As a straight answer as to why it doesn't come pre-equipped anymore, a combination of things, a combination of trying to maintain a kind of accessible retail price point, and also for probably the bulk of tourers, most don't utilise a front rack on a daily or a more regular basis, so it means that maybe 80% plus of the riders don't need a front rack, so it was an obvious area where we could pull back on the spec, but maintain other areas of spec at that level where you want them to be held high.
Yeah, and it's got a very cool colour. That's a very different blue to the blue that I bought.
Well,
mine in.
Yeah, interestingly, probably up until, as you say, maybe 5-6 years ago, this market was very, very traditional, and the bikes had to basically be British Racing Green or a very deep kind of dark royal blue, and much deviation from that would result in the kind of typical client at that point really not being interested. Touring and adventure riding, which is what probably more people call it now, has really opened up over the last few years, and you're seeing a much wider kind of age cross-section of people riding here now. So you can now get away with, you know, much brighter, lighter blues, silvers, oranges. You'll see also the Ramble, which is kind of one of our... It's a more modern take on a traditional touring bike in much more, you know, kind of contemporary colours. But it's maybe like the car market, where 10 years ago a car was either black, white or silver, but now, you know, any colour goes. Bikes have become much the same. So tastes have kind of moved on, and people are now looking for something that's maybe just a little bit more more contemporary.
And it's definitely still a bike that you can explore the world on.
Absolutely. I mean, the primary idea of this bike as a panorama is absolutely still to be, it's a bike, you can take it anywhere in the world, whether that be, you know, first world, second world, whether it be desert, whether it be roads, whether it be off-road, and the bike will fundamentally do the job it needs to do, which is get you from A to B.
I was genuinely impressed with what Ridgeback had done to the Panorama World bike, but then my gaze was averted elsewhere, to the Netherlands and to Friesland.
I am Sander Deyle, and I am sales coordinator at Van Nicolas, responsible for all the sales and after sales worldwide. Looking at the Defron at this moment, Defron is a trekking bike with an 18 gears pinion system in it.
Can I just say it's a trekking bike deluxe?
Yes.
8,133 euros.
Yeah.
Right, keep going.
All our bikes are custom built, so what you see is the most expensive version of a Defron bike. It's got a lot of titanium parts.
And how long does it take for you to make that particular model of bike?
Yeah, it's custom built, so you can configure it on our website, and after receiving the order, it will take about 3 weeks to build. A mechanic is around between two or three hours busy to build the bike.
And the chain is quite a unique chain. It's not a metal chain.
No, it's a carbon gate drive. Maintain free, so easy to use if you are on trekking worldwide, because the Defron is really a trekking bike.
And have you had customers who have taken this around the world?
Yes, we gave this bike to Kevin Buray, and he drove 3,500 kilometers through Europe with not any problem with it. So we are selling this to people who don't want to have a roll-off hub, because we also have a Pioneer bike, almost the same geometry, but this one is with an 18 gears pinion transmission.
I have to say it's a beautiful touring bike, and if I had 8,000 euros, I'd probably buy it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, entry level, it's also possible to not build it with the titanium parts, and also with a normal Shimano front dynamo hub. Entry level around 5,500
euros. 5,500
euros,
that's a...
what I'll
buy ordering
say.
Tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Perfect, thank you. So at least I now had a choice, a Ridgeback Panorama for about £1,400 or a Van Nicolas for between 5 and 8,000 euros. I decided to put that decision on hold and turn my thoughts to something slightly cheaper, which was a comfy ride.
Hello, my name's Kat. I am Pedal Shed Limited. I make splash-proof, comfortable, stylish saddle covers to fit pretty much any saddle out there. They're incredibly colourful, three layers of textile, so there's a lining which protects you against a wet or sticky saddle. I make them from upcycled designer textiles from Danish design furniture, and they really improve your ride because they're quite comfortable to sit on, and they jazz up your ride too. They're nice to look at.
So I have my bike options, I have a saddle cover, but one thing I won't be changing is my tyres, the Schwalbe Marathon Plus, and here's why.
Hello, I'm Tim from Schwalbe Tyres. We're the UK distributor for the Schwalbe brand, here in the UK, obviously. And Andrew's asked me why he's had such good experiences with the Marathon Plus tyres over all the years and thousands of kilometres that he's been cycling. Well, it's a tyre that we've developed over many years, starting with the original Marathon back in the 1980s. And then about 20 years ago, we introduced the Plus version, which significantly increased the interest level in the tyre because of its extra punch protection. But it's really a combination of a good quality carcass, that's the foundation to any tyre, and we use what's known as a 67 EPI or TPI, threads per inch as it's more commonly known, carcass, which is generally higher than a lot of standard touring tyres, so that gives a supple, lower rolling resistance carcass. The compound, the endurance compound, again has been developed over many years, and producing a rubber compound that gives good wear and cut resistance characteristics doesn't add too much to the rolling resistance, but equally offers acceptable levels of grip, depending on the type of tyre that you're looking at, is very difficult. And it's a sort of a three-way balance between all of those factors. And we think with the endurance compound for the Marathon Plus, we found the perfect balance between all those three factors. And then if you add in the 5 to 6 millimetre smart guard layer that's included in as puncture protection level in all the Marathon Pluses, which is a very dense, springy rubber that provides good resistance to penetration, but at the same time, although it adds obviously a bit of weight to the tyre, doesn't unduly affect the rolling resistance. So you add all those things together and you come up with the Marathon Plus, which is the tyre that you like and has served you so well.
There you go. Everything you ever wanted to know about the Marathon Plus tyre, but were afraid to ask.
And a bit of innuendo thrown in for good measure. So, the bike, tick. The seat cover, tick. The tyres, tick. I now need to record my adventure with the best camera kit on the market.
Hi, my name is Andreas. I'm working at GoPro. So here we are with a new product which we have already released like 1 year ago almost. It's the Hero 5 together with the Karma drone. The cool thing about the Karma drone is pretty much that you have not only a drone, you have a drone plus a gimbal which stabilizes your videos, and you have the camera itself, right? So you can just get the camera outside and chuck it into other devices here. You can also fold the drone together into a smaller bit, and then you can get it into your backpack. And yeah, when we look at the camera itself, it is voice controlled right now. So you can say it's just easy, GoPro start recording, and it will start recording. The resolution improved with a better frame a second time. And we have a big new thing is right now that it's not anymore in a housing right now. It's already waterproof without the housing, which makes it just great in terms of filming and especially in audio quality, because you don't need to record the audio through a housing, and it got 3 different microphones. It's video stabilized itself, and if you want to have a really perfectly smooth video, you just take your Karma grip. And yeah, you got really like cinema quality.
But hang on, this is Brexit Britain. American GoPro sold by Germans, German Schwalbe tyres, seat covers inspired by Danish designers, Dutch luxury touring bikes, and a Ridgeback Panorama made in Taiwan. Aren't there any British bike options open to me?
So I'm John O'Sykes. I work for Orange Bikes down in Hollywell Green in Halifax, West Yorkshire. And we build all of our full suspension bikes in Halifax. We're owned by a guy that is the nephew of one of the original owners. He is a local guy. He owns the fabrication place and the assembly factory now. Orange is a brand. We make a few thousand bikes a year, all built from sheet metal in West Yorkshire, folded, formed into our bikes, which are then finished in Halifax, powder coated in 10 different colours. With custom specs, you know, great story really. It's nice to be part of a British brand and still be making bikes in the UK, which is a real rarity. And you know, everybody in the company rides. It's a real local story, and it's nice that we're having a bit of a resurgence with Ashley taking over about 2 years ago from the original owners. So yeah, it's really good.
And what
makes
Orange Bikes distinct in terms of mountain biking compared to other brands?
The main thing is the British built thing, which has already spoke about. Then it's the single pivot design of the frame, which has come on and evolved over recent years. We've got a lot of weight out the frames, the performance, the stiffness. It's still right up there, cutting edge with the aluminium, the really reliable, strong, performance orientated designs, the confidence inspiring geometry, which has been at the forefront of modern trail geometry for the last, you know, 10 years or more than that, really. That's what sets us apart. You know, we do everything individual. Whereas a lot of the other brands, the way they work is different to us. They have to buy large volumes and they don't have the flexibility that we do because we're a small British company.
Did he mention they were British? The problem is that Orange make mainly mountain bikes, very good ones, but I think I'll stick to something made for long distance travel instead. Talking of which, where shall I go? I could get someone to organise the whole thing for me, I suppose.
Hi, I'm David. I'm a cycling product manager at Exodus Travels. We offer guided and self-guided holidays all over the world. Guided being for groups between 4 and 16 with a guide and support vehicles. Self-guided being groups of any size but without a guide. On our self-guided trips, we arrange transportation of luggage and overnight accommodation, but leave you to find your own way and take your time about the route. On our guided trips, we arrange meals, flights, leaders, accommodation and transport, but supply a guide to show you the best of the destination.
And if you were to recommend one trip?
Cycling in Mongolia would probably be my top trip.
Wow.
So 21 days of wild camping out in the Mongolian steppe, but with the support of local Mongolian guides and assistants. They take you to nomadic families who live out in the wild. You drink mare's milk, fermented mare's milk. You eat curds. You get completely stuck in with Mongolian culture in somewhere that you could never access on your own.
That's not quite true. Well, we find out more about cycling in Mongolia in the November podcast. But perhaps you fancy something a little nearer to home. And here's something that sounds very familiar.
Well, my name is Ted Hayton, and we run a company called Continental Drifting Limited, and we specialise in coast-to-coast tours through Spain and France. The Spanish tour is a 10-day tour, and averaging about 70 miles a day. The cycling is occasionally testing, but leisurely. And we take in areas of Spain that most tourists would never ever see. We roughly follow the old Plata de la, the old Via de la Plata route.
Ah yes, the Via de la Plata. You can read all about cycling the Via de la Plata in Spain to Norway on a bike called Reggie, of course. But what about if I want to set off in, say, winter? Are there any options? Mallorca?
Hi, my name is Isaac Cruz. I'm the owner of Bergante Bikes. We are a bicycle rental in Mallorca, Spain. And we're here to try to show all the possibilities there are in Mallorca for cycling, cycle tourism, due to the good weather we have in the island, the beautiful roads and landscapes, as well as the easy connections with the island, with direct flights from most of the international airports in Europe.
Sounds very tempting. So let's imagine I headed off to Mallorca on my 8,000 euro Van Nicolas bike, with my good old Schwalbe Marathon Plus tyres and my colourful pedal shed saddle cover, and film the whole thing on my GoPro Hero 5 stabilised camera drone. All I need now is a bit of art to stick above the fire to help me remember the whole thing fondly.
Hello, I'm Jenny from Mark Sanderson Art. Mark is my husband and he's an illustrator, and he creates custom illustrations for the cycling world. So if you want to be seen as a bit of a cartoon character or have something that looks a bit like you with your bike, then come and see us on Stand F6 at the Cycle Show.
Ah, sorry Jenny, a bit too late. Unfortunately, by the time you listen to this, the Cycle Show 2017 will have finished, but I'm sure they'll all be back there next year in 2018 doing exactly the same thing. Time to head to Spain, kind of. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to chat to one of the stage winners of this year's Vuelta a España. It's Monday the 4th of September, and joining me from Logroño in northern Spain, where it's the second rest day of this year's Vuelta, is the young Slovenian rider Matej Mavrič, winner of stage 7 of this year's race. He cycles for UAE Team Emirates and he has been described as a whiz kid in the cycling world. In 2013, he became under 23 world champion. He's still only 22, speaks numerous languages, and he's quoted as saying that cycling is a ticket for the freedom to travel long distances. Well, I can sympathise with him there, although I suspect he does it a bit quicker than me. Hi, Matte.
Hi.
Welcome to the cyclingeurope.org podcast. First question, how did you get into cycling?
I started to practice cycling when I was 12 years old as a kid. I was given a race bike by my local club, where I spent my first 9 years of career. And after I turned professional, with Team Cannondale in Italy in 2014. And it's been 4 years now that I'm professional, and this year I'm riding for the Team UAE Emirates.
When you were growing up in Slovenia, is there one person who inspired you to become a professional cyclist?
Yeah, that would be my neighbor from my village in Slovenia. I grew up in the mountains, in a mountainous region. And my friend, a bit older than me, he started to practice cycling. And I did that because he said that it was quite a nice thing to do and quite a nice thing to spend one's free time.
Is Slovenia a good place to cycle?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic place to cycle because we have quite a diverse landscape. There's lots of climbs. There's plenty of flat also. And the cycling is a really popular sport amongst the people. Many people cycle for recreation and to keep fit and healthy. And it's we have a nice and pleasant summer that are not too warm. But in the winter, it's maybe a little bit too cold to ride a bike, so people do other stuff like hiking or running or similar.
Congratulations on winning stage 7 of the Vuelta. At what point did you think you might be able to win it?
Yeah, thank you. I knew that there was another 3 good riders chasing at the back, so I went full gas all the way to the finish line, and I only realized at the finish line that I've won. It was a big relief, and I was really happy for myself and also for the team.
The last few kilometers of stage 7 was a descent into historic Cuenca. You adopted quite a distinct position on the bike, I noticed.
Yes, I was always pretty good at descending. Sometimes when I'm on my own in the race, if I'm very on the if I'm riding on my limit, I sit on my top tube and pedal at the same time, though I think it's very dangerous and one shouldn't do that at home.
Doesn't look very comfortable.
No, it's not too comfortable.
What kind of speed can you reach in that position?
It depends on the gradient. You can probably go up to 100 or more k an hour.
Not recommended. Looking forward to the final week of the Vuelta, there are some quite mountainous stages to come in the north of Spain. Have you identified any where you think you have a chance of a podium finish?
Yeah, the two stages that suit me the most in this week are the Thursday and Friday stages. Especially the one on the Friday is really suited to my characteristics. So for sure I will try and get in the breakaway of the day to try to get one more stage win.
Good luck with that. You're currently 44th in the general classification. Do you think Chris Froome has the race in the bag?
It's hard to say. The Vuelta is still 6 more days of racing. For sure the tomorrow TT will suit him well. And he might get some more advantage there, but then we have 5 more hard stages coming, and especially the one on Saturday with the finish on Angliru is really, really tough. So obviously we will all have to give our best, and we will see what the route says, what the results will be.
You're now cycling for UAE Team Emirates, and before that, as you mentioned, you cycled for Cannondale. Prior to turning pro, however, you were with the Slovenian national amateur team, Sava. How does cycling for a large pro team compare to being an amateur?
It's completely different. The sport itself is a lot different. The distances are a lot longer. The intensity is higher and the level is much, much more competitive here in the pro cycling. But also the support of the team is much greater, and it's been very good for me in the last 4 years. I've enjoyed being a professional cyclist, and I hope to keep doing so for the next couple of years.
How do you see your career progressing? You haven't yet done the Tour de France. Is that a possibility for next year?
Yes, definitely. I think in the next couple of years I might appear there. And I've been professional for 4 years now, but I'm still amongst the youngest professionals out there. I'm only 22 years old now, so I have many years of racing ahead of me, and I hope to develop further as a cyclist.
You said that you'd love to win the Giro d'Italia. Is that because of the proximity of Italy to Slovenia?
Yeah, it might be. I really liked racing in Italia, in Italy. I've done many races in Italy, even as an amateur rider, and as a when I was little, we also raced in Italy very often, so I have special memories there. And I hope to do well in the future in Giro d'Italia.
Well, good luck in all the Grand Tour events. When cycling in the big races, do you ever get a chance to explore any of the areas as a tourist would?
No, not at all. We don't see any cities that we travel to. We only see the race bubble, as we name it. It's only like we stay at the hotel. We drive to the race start with the team bus. We do the race itself, and then after the race with the bus, we go back to the next to the next hotel. And it's a pretty busy day for us, a day of racing. So we don't see any. We can't do any sightseeing or so. So. We don't see much of the world that we travel.
Is that disappointing?
No, not too much. I'm pretty tired at the races most of the time, so I don't mind just taking a rest in the hotel.
Do you go cycling when you're not racing? Bikepacking, for example?
No, definitely not. We're way, way too tired from the season after we get home. So we usually our holiday is usually just to stay at home, to stay with your friends, with your family, and enjoy some rest. And that's pretty much all we do, because we have plenty of travel and flights and distances we go over the season, over the year. So the best thing for us is just to rest at home and relax.
If you could choose three things to achieve in your life and career over the next 10 years, what would they be?
First and foremost, I would like to stay happy in my life, to create a family, and to be happy in that kind of sense. And then I would like to continue my success as a cyclist. And I don't know about the third thing. For now, I like my life the way it is, and I wouldn't change much of it.
I was told you speak 7 languages. Do you speak them all as well as you speak English?
No, I only speak, I'm fluent in English, in Slovenian, obviously, in Italian, and in German. I don't know about the other three. I do learn French now, but I'm not fluent yet, so I don't know, maybe in the future.
Someone said that you're too clever to be a cyclist. Do you agree?
I don't know, I don't think so. I've been pretty successful as a cyclist, I think, and I like it the way it is, so I just try to do my best, and I will see how the future works out.
After your cycling career, could you pursue an academic career, do you think, with your languages?
If I would wish so, definitely yes. But for now, I don't know yet about my future after cycling. I didn't think about it too much. And for now, I'm focused on my cycling career. And in the future, I will see what life brings to me.
Mate didn't win any of the stages in the final week of the race, but he did finish in a creditable 30th position in the general classification. I would imagine we'll hear much more about him in the years to come. My own rise to cycling stardom, kind of, kicked off with my long-distance cycle from the UK to Italy a few years ago. And with that in mind, for this next piece of the podcast, I'm going to hand over to, well, me, in a Brussels hotel room. Cue genuine sound effect.
Hello.
You might have guessed that I've arrived in a big city, and the big city is Brussels. Now, I've been invited here by a chap called Richard Weston, who's an academic at the University of Central Lancashire. And the reason why we're here is, well, I'm not 100% sure, but it is to do with Eurovelo 5, of all things. That was the route that I cycled back in 2010, and which was the basis of the book Crossing Europe on a Bike Called Reggie. So far so good. Travelled down the train from Yorkshire, and I'm now awaiting further instructions, really, as to where to meet Richard and exactly what we're going to be doing over the course of the next 48 hours. Once the emergency services of Brussels had moved on, I did indeed find Richard. In the hall that was hosting the Bike Brussels event that was taking place at the same time as the Eurovelo 5 project meeting, I asked him what it was all about.
Our project was designed really to identify the parts of Eurovelo 5 that were usable. So obviously large stretches are still not suitable, but we wanted to find the bits that we could invite tourists to come and cycle, and then around those to develop some tourism packages to encourage them to come and visit and to cycle between countries, because you know you can on sections of the route you can be in three or four or five countries within a couple of days. This is our final partner meeting where we're bringing all of our outputs together. We're launching the website with all the new information about the route, the app that users can use to follow and find interesting things to see and do along the route. And so we are hoping that it will generate some new interest in cycling across Europe.
The project involves many partners, national cycling organisations such as Sustrans here in the UK and the FIAB in Italy, as well as commercial tour operators who sell organised cycle holidays. The project is coordinated by the people in charge of the Eurovelo network of cycle routes, the European Cyclists' Federation, or ECF. And you're about to hear first from Ed Lancaster of the ECF, and then from Graham Vickers of the specialist tour operator Skedaddle.
So I'm Ed Lancaster, a senior policy officer at the European Cyclists' Federation, ECF, and I work primarily on developing the Eurovelo network together with my colleagues. Our vision for the Eurovelo network is to realise all 15 routes that there currently exist. As you know from cycling, Andrew, they're in different states of development, the routes, and even within some routes there are different statuses. So the idea is to take the best practices from the most developed routes and to share those experiences with the other routes to bring them all up to the same standard for cycle tourists. At the moment we have a vision to 2020. We're just about to start work on a vision for 2030. And we're always adding to the network. There's a process by which you can formally add routes to the network. And so we have three routes currently going through the application process at the moment.
I'm Graham Vickers from a cycle tour operator, Saddle Skedaddle, based up in Newcastle in the UK. I'm the product development specialist within that company. We are actually offering holidays along certain parts of Italy, southern Italy, around by Rome in Tuscany. We've been helping the Kent area to develop their product and their offer to the locals. And what we're also doing is, rather than just being here to sell holidays, we're actually lending our speciality as a tour operator and the knowledge of the local offer to actually help within the project for other people to benefit from that route as well.
Well, hopefully by 2030 we'll have a realised route up to the standard of the Eurovelo 15, the Rhine Cycle route, which is our most developed of all the routes we have at the moment. I think the project that's just finished is a good starting point. It's brought together a good partnership that we can build on in developing the network. And already we've seen in the last 18 months lots of good developments, the website, various promotional tools. In the UK, Sustrans are doing good work with the local authorities to install signposting, and that's also been copied in other parts of the route. In France, they have Eurovelo signposting. So I'm confident by 2030, that's definitely going to be one of the routes that will be ready for cycle tourists to cycle, all types of cycle tourists, from families up to the more experienced cycle tourists.
Finally, back to Richard Weston. I asked him if he thought that there were many people out there wanting to cycle the entire route of the Eurovelo 5 from Canterbury to Brindisi.
Interesting question, and I think there will be people who will see this and think, yes, I want to do that, in the way that people do the C2C. They see it as a challenge to complete it. I think there's more likely to be a larger number who do it over a series of visits. So some of the other Eurovelo routes, people do them 2 weeks at a time, and they have their summer holidays, and then they go home, and then next year they come back and do the next bit, which actually will give us an opportunity to fill in some of the gaps. Hopefully we'll just stay ahead of them in completing the route.
So the Eurovelos are not just for people like me who fancy doing the entire route, which is probably good news for most people. You can find the new website at eurovelo.com, and the app is now available to download. Just search for Eurovelo 5. Similar apps are also available for Eurovelo 6 along the Danube and Eurovelo 13, the Iron Curtain Trail. There was something rather ironic about my trip to Brussels to attend the Eurovelo 5 meeting. When I cycled the route in the wet, cold summer of 2010, I was keen to find the dry and heat of southern Europe, so I actually cut off the bit of the route that passes through Belgium. However, Richard's invitation to Brussels included the offer to do a bit of cycling in the capital, including a ride along some of the Eurovelo 5 route that I'd missed. We met up with Frederic de Portera, who works for the Brussels Regional Authority. His job is to develop the cycling facilities of the city and its suburbs, and he was our guide. I asked him to describe the current cycle network.
Well, Brussels destroyed its actual cycle lanes during the 50s and 60s. There were many of them. And so we were busy rebuilding them on bigger roads, but that will take us a long time. But in the meantime, we built up this very interesting cycle network using traffic-calmed streets. So it's a smaller street with speed bumps and just signage. Signage that has 12 routes, as, like a clock, and then three ring routes, and four transversal routes going through the city, canal route, for example.
And do you have any statistics as to how many people commute from home to work or into the centre on bike compared to public transport or on their cars?
Yes, we think that the current modal share of bicycles for commuting is 7% nowadays. 7% of all traffic.
And how does that compare with, say, Paris or London? Or
it's more, actually, more than Paris and London. I think London is 5 and Paris is about 5-ish as well.
Okay.
So we have, we're smaller, of course, so distances are rather short. It's a half hour on the maximum to get from the outskirts of the region to the centre, to the Place La Bourse in the centre. So it's never a long journey. So that's, I think, why it's even if the infrastructure is not better than London or Paris, there's more people cycling. It's a very compact city with short distances.
Like most big cities, Brussels has its own bike hire scheme. I'd seen plenty of docking stations since arriving in the capital, and I asked Frederick if the scheme was successful, but got an answer that I wasn't really expecting.
Not really, if I'm really honest. We expected it to be far more successful. I think that the bicycles are just too heavy for a hilly city like Brussels. They have seven gears, but they're much too heavy. So we're thinking about electrifying them or looking for other solutions.
He went on to explain that the proportion of people already owning a bike was high, so this meant that they didn't need to use one of the public bikes in the first place. Before setting off, I dropped a bit of a clanger.
And finally, this weekend is bike-free Sunday?
Bike-free Sunday, that's a good one. No, it's car-free Sunday, actually.
Sorry, car-free Sunday.
A very good one. I mean, the rest of the week is bike-free week, but that's about 15th time we do car-free Sunday. The whole region, which is the biggest area in Europe or even the world, that's car-free for one day, of course. I mean, the desert is car-free as well, but biggest urban area which is car-free for one day is Brussels, 160 square kilometres.
And with that, we were off. Richard and Frederick on traditional bikes, me on a Brompton.
Are we currently following the Eurovelo 5?
Yes, that's Eurovelo 5. It's a bit of a side road that we use to avoid a busy crossing, a four-lane roundabout, which is something that new cyclists or inexperienced cyclists want to avoid if you want to go straight on as a as an experienced cyclist, please do.
So, Richard, how do you compare cycling in Brussels to cycling back home in Britain?
It's certainly much better in terms of cycling a city. The infrastructure is better, the surfaces are better, the traffic drivers are more respectful.
I think what you're trying to say is everything is better.
Everything, yes, yeah. It's really interesting to... I live in a small market town where perhaps we don't have the same issues as a city, but I didn't imagine cycling in a city could be quite so pleasant, really. A nice way to spend a Saturday morning having a look at some of the sights of Brussels and enjoying a bit of autumn sunshine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beautiful.
OK. We're now cycling on an old railway. The one that got from Brussels to Trevuren, where the avenue leads you as well. The train stopped running in the 60s, and then the tracks lay abandoned for about 30 years. And by the end of the 90s, people started thinking about making it to a slow route for cyclists and pedestrians. It's becoming so successful that it's actually a victim of its own success. There's too many people trying to use the route. Commuters use the route in the morning. They tend to drive fast, so the elderly people who want to let out their dogs get into trouble with commuters. And especially on nice weekends, it's crowded. It just shows you that city people need places to be outside of the noise of traffic and want to move outside of traffic. So we need more of this. Actually, there's actually 75 kilometers of potential reuse of train routes in the Brussels capital region. Sometimes where the train still runs, but there's enough place to put in a cycle lane next to it. So.
And if we continued down here, where would we get to eventually?
We'd get to the university campus in Etterbeek, where this train joins the existing train tracks that go to Luxembourg. One of those hidden secrets of Brussels are the city garden towns. Garden towns, like the Sunlight town in Liverpool. There's tens of them, and there's 25, 28 of them around Brussels. So you can do a tour around these garden cities, or a tour around architecture or green spaces in Brussels, or even exotic food in Brussels. Or there's different kinds of subjects that you can pick out, and that's the best way to discover Brussels as it really is.
That message was brought to you by Provelo Brussels.
They're an NGO, so
Have you seen an improvement in the accident figures for cyclists as a result of all the measures that have been put in place?
No, but we have seen an increase in cycle use. So on the whole, cycling is not very dangerous. There's less than one fatal accident per year, which is a good number, even if it's one too much every 2 years. But most accidents tend to be small accidents, minor accidents. So we have seen a steady increase in cycling for the last 10, 15 years. Last year we had a 30% increase in 1 year. And the level of accidents stays the same, more or less. It's increasing, but at the same level of the increase of cyclists. So it's not, we're not yet having a sort of effect on safety in numbers. I think you have to have more than 10 or 15% of cyclists for that. But for the moment, there's no increase in accidents, even if we know that most of new cyclists are new cyclists who have not experienced. So there is probably a safety in numbers effect, because there's lots of new cyclists that haven't been cycling for the last 10 years. and there's not more fatal or bad accidents in statistics. So, of course, you have to be careful, especially minor accidents are underreported. But we know that fatal accidents or major accidents are well reported, and that's the only statistics you can really trust, and they are quite okay for Brussels. Especially because traffic is so slow, and I think speed is one of the main reasons for accidents in an urban environment, with cyclists especially. And there's quite few lorries driving through the city.
Yeah, I know. Which makes it Saturday, but
yeah.
No
so
traffic.
we don't have this dead angle. If we have a fatal accident, it's most of the time it's a lorry.
Yeah.
It's sometimes a tram. We had one fatal. Last one was with a tram. But most fatal accidents for the last 10, 15 years were with lorries, blind spot accidents. But there's quite few of them compared to, for example, London or Paris, where it's a big problem. And I think it's just because our streets are too narrow for lorries to drive through the city. It's such a compact town. There's no through traffic from lorries to Brussels. They're on the ring road. They're outside of the city. There's only destination lorries. And I suppose that those people know the city quite well and are careful. So there's very few very bad accidents with cyclists in Brussels. We had two accidents with lorries on roundabouts this year, but they were luckily not non-fatal. But those are the worst accidents that happens in a city anywhere, but in Brussels as well. But we don't have a lot of them, thank God.
So I would have thought that even on a Saturday morning, if you were cycling on an equivalent road in London, there would be lots of...
Yeah, with more lorries. Yeah. So there must be ways to getting the lorries out of your city. There's a tax on lorries, so a kilometre tax, sort of congestion charge. So it avoids lorries to drive through the city. But already before, we know that it doesn't happen. People drive their lorries to their destination in Brussels, but they will never drive through Brussels because it's too traffic jammed. I mean, it's no use, so they drive around Brussels.
Yeah, I think probably the most dangerous thing about cycling is people holding iPhones with microphones on them, trying to cycle at the same time.
If they're cycling, yeah.
That was a really nice few days with Richard and the people of the European Cyclist Federation in Brussels. There's a similar project taking place for the Eurovelo 8, the route that I cycled in 2013, and it would be wonderful to get involved in that too. If I do, you'll hear about it here first on the Cycling Europe podcast. That said, cycling in Brussels contrasted starkly with the experience of being a cyclist here in the UK. But things are looking up. We've made big strides in the right direction in recent years, and last week I had the opportunity to find out what was happening to try and improve the local cycling infrastructure close to where I live in Calderdale. So I've returned from Brussels and I'm now back in West Yorkshire, and more specifically I'm in a small village called Rippendin, which is in the Calder Valley, or not far from the Calder Valley. In fact, it's in the Ryburn Valley, and there are plans here to turn what used to be an old railway track into one of the greenways, similar, hopefully, to what I've seen recently in Brussels, but also elsewhere. In Spain, the Vías Verdes are really good examples, and also in Waterford, where I was earlier in the summer. And I'm hopefully going to meet up with somebody called Corrine, who is going to show me how far the plan is progressing to change the boggy, muddy, disused railway line into something which is a bit more user-friendly.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
You're right.
Andrew.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Well, thanks
for
coming down.
It's all right.
Where does it actually start from here?
Well.
I've done the other way. Right, so we've arrived at the Rippendin end, or really it's in the middle, isn't it, of
the
Greenway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're looking down from a bridge down towards, well, in the direction of Rishworth. Could you just explain what the plan is over the course of the next, I don't know, a few years, I would imagine, in order to get this thing up and running?
Sure. I mean, we're just a group of residents who came together around the time of the Tour de France when people were talking about legacy projects. So we've been working with the council to get this project to this position since then, since back in 2013. We're now in the middle of public consultation. There's no line actually on the map, despite what people think. You know, common sense does tell you that the old rail line should be used, but we're now in the middle of finding out whether that's what people want. There's been three pop-up events that have taken place in the Ryburn Valley in the last month, and I think the online consultation continues for another 6 weeks.
Because what we can see down here is a clearly defined, disused railway track. Clearly it's all silted up and it's a fairly muddy track, but it's clearly defined, and it, you know, from a layman's perspective, it wouldn't take a great deal of work, I don't think, in stretches like that, to actually change that into something which is walkable and also cyclable.
That's right, yeah. I mean, our motivation was to create something that was open to everyone, as many people as possible. There's no reason why people with young children or whether you're low mobility should be able to access places like this. It's the flattest land we've got in the region. And at the moment, it's only available to those people who are pretty fit and active and well. And that's, it doesn't seem right, really, that.
So when did the railway line close?
Ooh, I think it was in the 60s after the beaching cuts then.
So that's sort of 50 years ago. Why has nothing happened from the 60s until now?
I don't think there was a need. I don't think there was a need for it. Ripponden itself has changed much in the last 20 years. Sawbridge Bridge has got much, much busier. And I think when the council have tried to do this in the past, there hasn't really been much public will. They were happy with the quieter road and they were happy with accessing the countryside in different ways. But now the region is a lot busier. There's a lot more people here and there's a lot more need to get cars off the road and people more active. And I think that's why this project has now got to where it has.
And also, to a certain extent, Ripponden, probably more so than Sowy Bridge, but Ripponden is a bit of a tourist destination.
It can be. There's lots of untapped potential. At the moment, it's kind of a bit hidden away. There's a beautiful old pub at the Bridge Inn down at the bottom that only locals really utilise, because nobody walks through that way, or very few people walk that way. And the beautiful St Bart's Church as well. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, you've got lots of pubs. You've got a fair few restaurants down there as well. And you've also got easy access to lots of walking routes.
Yeah.
You can access, for example, over the moors up to the reservoir and then Cragvale, for example.
That's it. We see, or the group see this potentially to open up their Ryburn Valley to a lot more people in the same way that Hebden Bridge does with the Calder Valley. You know, we have so many existing footpaths and bridleways that aren't linked, and they go all around the reservoirs up to the top and then over to the Calder Valley. It really would open up the entire place to a lot more people.
Right, so should we take a walk in that direction towards Rishworth, just to kind of experience what it is to walk on the path as it is at the moment?
To where you've been previously as well. It's a different... I think because that bridle is not at the bottom, people use it differently. So the path stays up high, and in a way, it's a lot less accessible because, well, you'll see. It gets to a point where you feel like you're on a ridge between two great big gullies.
So in terms of the reaction and the support of the local community, have you had that?
On the whole, yes. Over the last 4 years, we've talked to thousands of people, especially down Sora Bridge, about this project, and the overwhelming support in Sora Bridge is there. People just can't see the issues. They've said, why isn't it done sooner, actually?
Well, that was my reaction.
Yeah,
why is something that could potentially be changed so relatively easily not being done before?
Yeah, and that was my reason, actually, for getting involved in this back in 2013. But as we've come up the valley towards Ripponden, there is some objections from people who unfortunately can't see the benefits to the wider community. We're hoping in time they'll change their mind when they see it up and running and see the good it's doing.
And are these people who own the land, are these people who just don't want it by their houses? Or?
I think so in the main. You know, we in the last 15 years, Ripponden's had a lot of house building here, and in the big estates where there's a lot of families, we've also talked to people. We've gone out to events on the Tour of Yorkshire, that sort of thing, and talked to these families up there. They want it. They want a place that their children can come and enjoy as a family, and as they get older, the schools are down that way. They'd love them to be able to walk to school or ride to school. We get a load of support from that. I think it is just a small but vocal few.
Yeah. And what's the reaction been of the council? How supportive have they been?
Once we proved to them the support in the wider public, they saw the potential to. They've got targets to meet in terms of getting people off roads, because we live in such a built-up area and we live in an area where everyone's pushed into the valleys. So they really do need with population growth to get people out of cars as possible. There's a whole thing about Active Calderdale, which is a really good initiative that they're trying to get people to walk to work, cycle to work, because it's not just good for people, it's good for the economy, and it's good for the environment as well. It's I can't see a downside to it, really.
No, neither can I. And is the Ryburn Valley Greenway part of the Calderdale cycle strategy?
Yes, it is. They want to encourage more people to cycle as part of this wider strategy to improve living conditions in Calderdale, and it was adopted this year.
The riverside path, yeah.
But there's nothing off the main road to tell people that it's here.
Yeah. I mean, it's inevitable. You're always going to, if you have a greenway, you're inevitably going to have to get from your front door to the to wherever it is. So it wouldn't be such a disaster.
No, I think the on and off points need to be carefully thought about, really. So there's this one. I'll look through the trees. Where are we at?
So people who lived in that area would presumably come across this bridge, perhaps a bit of a revamped bridge,
yep,
a bit wider, and then somehow make, because that's quite steep, isn't it?
It is. So this is why the on and off points need thinking about. So Rishworth hopefully should be easy.
Yeah.
It's the end point. This, not so easy. Okay for walkers, but maybe not much for anybody else with wheels.
Mm.
This path down here is lovely. One of my favourite walk. You see, this is in a way is up for a potential route as well. And I, like you said, with the path up there, why put something here when there's something already built? It would just look so much more.
Right, so we've returned to Rippendin in the rain, and to me, it is clearly something that should have been done a long time ago. What happens next?
Okay.
And when is it going to happen, and who will fund it, etc.?
Ah, right. So those are the big questions. We are still in consultation, as I've said. We've probably got another 6 weeks of consultation. The people running that, the council and their partners, will then come back, look at all the comments from everybody, put together a route based on those comments and a bit more detail of the route, hopefully. The public is then will be asked again to comment on those findings. So it's a two-phase process. And I guess after that final consultation, detailed plans will be drawn up. In terms of timescale and funding, I don't know. At the moment, I'm just a member of the public, privy to as much information as everybody else, so that'll be as and when the council want to give us that information.
Do you think it's a reasonable expectation to say, I'm guessing, 5 years?
I'd hope so. Yeah, these things don't happen fast, but I would like to think 5 years is reasonable. I mean, even if it just gets broken down into chunks and the easy section from Sorough Bridge to Gebroid happens, in my eyes, that can happen really fast.
Now, I've just said goodbye to Corinne. She had to go and feed her kids, which is a reasonable excuse. And she pointed me in the direction of a bit of the greenway, potential greenway, near Rippendin, but on the other side of the main road through the village. And she particularly wanted me to read a leaflet that's been produced by some people who don't want the greenway to come. And it says, quite clearly on the sign, "The woods are in danger. Please take a leaflet." And I've picked up a leaflet, and I shall read through it at length when I get home. But on the back, I'm quoted, kind of. "The consultation has been heavily promoted in cycling communities. They have international organisations promoting the consultation to their international membership." They've spelt the word "there" wrong, incidentally, but we'll skip over that. And there's a reference to cyclingeurope.org and the article that I posted on there about the Greenway earlier this year in September. And then it says, "Why are the locals the last to know? What is the council hiding?" Well, it's a pity there's nobody here, because I'd be tempted to say, I am a local. I am a local, and I think it's a wonderful idea. So, hey, where are you? Come and have an argument with me. It looks as though they're all hiding in their rather nice, detached properties.
excuse me. Hi, the presumably the old railway line ran straight through your property.
There's a bridge there, the railway bridge.
Ah, right, okay.
And it went under there.
Ah, okay. So this actually wasn't part of the railway line here?
No, it was further on. If you see further on, there's a gate on the left-hand side.
I've just picked up the leaflet.
Yes.
Do you know who's written that? Have you seen that before? Or?
I've seen it before, yes, yeah. What we object to is the fact that this road is a terrible road. There's no... You can't see when you're going down there. There's no pavement.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that people come on here on bikes and they just shoot straight out.
Yeah.
It's not a very, you know, I mean, I don't object to that it's on there, but it's getting to it. That's the thing.
But if they improve the infrastructure of what you've got here for use by both cyclists and by walkers and by, you know, people like yourself who've got a car, would that be a good thing?
I don't know, because we know what bikers are like. We know exactly, I mean, I don't know whether you're a biker yourself, but we have a narrow boat and go on the canals, and when you go into a lock, you're dicing with death with cyclists going, I don't know what speed. They're supposed to get off at bridges. They don't. And so we've had, you know, I nearly got knocked down, actually. It was a very near thing. It's only my husband shouted at me that, and they don't ring the bells. You know, and some people say, well, they frighten people. I thought, well, I'd rather be frightened than run down.
So there are clearly still some people to convince. I think that will always be the case, quite frankly. That's it for episode 2. Episode 3 of the Cycling Europe podcast will be available to download on November 1st, and will have a celluloid theme to it, with filmmakers Barry Godin and the award-winning Jimmy Hyland, amongst others, and a report from the Leeds Bicycle Film Club. I'll see you in November.